Welcome to Parents Tool Talk Radio with your host, Jody Johnston Powell, licensed social worker, certified family life educator, second generation parent educator, and author of the award-winning book, The Parents Tool Shop, the universal blueprint for building a healthy family. For over 25 years, Jody has been training parents and family service professionals nationwide and serving as a parenting expert to the media worldwide. Now, through the Parents Tool Talk Show, Jody shares her practical advice and introduces you to other experts who can give you proven effective advice on the issues that matter most to parents. So get ready to be informed, entertained, and enlightened as we join Jody now.
So welcome, everyone, to Parents Tool Talk. And this has been a radio show, a teleseminar series, a webinar series, a web TV series. So welcome, everyone. And today I'm really excited to have Dr. Harriet Heath as our guest. She is a licensed developmental psychologist, parent educator, mother of three, and grandmother of eight. She's the founder and director emeritus of the Parent Center at Bryn Mawr College and is a visiting faculty member at DePaul University. Her parenting program, Parenting Creatively, aims to help parents feel more confident about the decisions they're making and more competent in carrying them out by focusing on the parents' values and beliefs and providing the information and skills they need. She has worked with parents from many walks of life, whose children ranged in age from newborn to young adults. She's currently facilitating virtual parent groups and consulting with the Women's Health Center at Cooley Dickinson Hospital in Northampton, Maine, Massachusetts?
Massachusetts.
Yes. Okay, we were talking about you living in Maine, and I read the MA there. That's where I thought you lived, in Massachusetts. So she's working there to develop a more extensive postpartum parental support program. So welcome, Harriet. I am so excited to reconnect.
I'm delighted to be here. Thank you for having me.
Yes. Harriet was also on one of my Parents Tool Talk radio shows almost 10 years ago. And today our topic is how to avoid the terrible twos, or how you and your toddler can thrive to make them terrific years instead of the myth of that it has to be terrible. So we're going to talk about all kinds of stuff. So I actually just kind of want to open up to Harriet and let you say anything else you want to introduce yourself and to share what you'd hope to get out of today. And then we'll check in with some of our guests who are listening a little bit later.
Well, we started looking, you brought up terrible twos, and how did they get that name? It goes back to Cassell back in the 1920s when they were studying child development, and they sort of categorized. There were the terrible twos, and then there was the wonderful threes and the frustrating fours. And I think we have to look at what's really going on with twos to understand why they were seen as so terrible and really what fascinating creatures they are. If you look at what's going on with two-year-olds, they're curious. Actually all people are curious. I was just reading about archaeologists studying new archaeological sites in Central America, and they're curious about people that lived back then, or they're astronomers looking at the outer space. We're curious people, and if we weren't curious, we wouldn't learn. So the two-year-old is curious too. And actually the ages I like to put in here is going back to when they start to crawl, which is 7, 8, 9, 10 months. And what's happened there is not only are they starting to move, they've also learned that objects they can't see still exist, which means there's a whole world out there to explore. So what you have a curious child who's driven by that curiosity. And by driven, I want you to think, how do you feel when you haven't eaten for 2 days? All you can think about is food, or if you haven't slept for 2 nights, all you can think about is sleeping. Well, curiosity drives a two-year-old like that. They want to see, they want to explore. They want to get into things. They're driven by that curiosity and where they can go. And they haven't very much developed that executive function up there in the brain to know what could happen, what's dangerous, what they should do and what they shouldn't do. So here you've got this child ready to go in a culture that talks about child-proofing your home for the crawling child. Well, what does child-proofing mean? Getting everything out of the way so the child can't break things. No wonder you have problems, because the child's urging to go and the environment saying, no, it's not safe. And you've got a clash. So instead, if we look at the child and ask, what is he interested in? What is he wanting to investigate? And how can we do it safely? So I think the advice should be the one we've got, child-proof your house and make it interesting. And we can do both.
Yeah.
So that's where we start. And you can see why they were terrible twos, because you had these two forces in opposition to each other. But if we stop and look at what the two-year-old or the developing child is trying to do, then we can start working with that curiosity instead of in opposition to it.
Yeah. And understanding that developmentally, the importance of curiosity and exploration is really key, because so many other behaviors children can have, adults can interpret them in different ways. So getting into everything, on the one hand, from a developmental standpoint, can be viewed very developmentally and positively as, this is curiosity, this is important for learning, which is the framework you've given us. But so many of us were raised maybe in families, or maybe there's more of a societal interpretation of that children should just kind of be calmer and sit still and obey, and which is really not what the two-year-old developmental stage is all about. So helping folks understand how that is important can maybe help translate to not only understanding it, not fighting it, but actually welcoming it. So I love it's not only let's prevent problems and keep them safe through the child-proofing, but it also allows us to be more relaxed. And then I love the fact that you're adding onto there, not only just like tolerate and make it safer, but let's actually encourage that curiosity by making it an interesting, more enriched environment. And I would imagine what you're also going to head into is how we can be involved with the child in helping them explore safely and creatively.
I just want to go back to the task of this age. Well, the task of all of our ages, the child is developing an internal mental representation of their world. And if you think of everything in your mind, you know, you had to remember to be on time today. You had to remember how you're going to say it. We have to remember what we're going to have for dinner. We think about how our childhood, all this is in our heads. Children have to develop all of that. And the two-year-old or the toddler is developing that mental representation, and they do it by investigating, by touching, by smelling. That's why it's called the sensory motor intelligence. They're building that, and that's their task. So yes, you brought it up. How do we work with it?
Yes.
And I have to say, first of all, it's a bind for parents, because we're working with keeping them safe and encouraging the development. And parents are in a wonderful position to do this because they know their child. Let me give you an example. My kids started climbing as soon as they could crawl. But I realized right at the beginning, and I've seen this on the playground for years ever since, when a child crawls, they have their four limbs firmly braced. One limb they let go to move up, then the other limb, and then one leg and the other leg. Three limbs are always firmly based. Now, if you see a child that's not doing that, you've got to watch that child. But if you see a child with three limbs, they know how to climb. Before I let them go too far, I'm sure that they know how to climb down so that we can, but most people do the same thing going down. So, but here's the parent role to think about what is the child doing and are they doing it safely? And being able to judge that. But there's another thing here too, and that's the temperament of the child. If you have a child who's climbing and very distractible on a busy playground, even though they're climbing properly, you've got to keep an eye on them because they're going to get distracted by something going on over there and forget to hold on. On the other hand, if you have a child who's very persistent and focused, then you can relax a little bit because whatever's going on, they're going to stay with it. And this is where parents' role is so important because parents know their child. They know they've got a distractible child or a persistent child. Yeah. And that helps them gauge what's safe and what's not.
Yeah.
So, that's the parent's role, and it's always a bind, one or the other. I have to say when we're talking about this, I'm biased. I value curiosity, and I want to keep my children's curiosity alive as well as safe. And so what we're going to be talking about, that bias is going to come through pretty strong. I want both.
So be up. I appreciate your being upfront about that.
They've got their values, and they need to be aware of what they are.
Sure. I remember hearing some kind of a story. I think it was about either Einstein or Edison, that a story of his mother and how he spilled milk one day, and instead of scolding him and immediately cleaning it up, she allowed him to like play with it almost like finger paint or something before involving him and cleaning up his mess for himself. So I think that someone with that bias and curiosity might take that kind of an approach instead of heading right for the paper towels of, oh, you know, let's look at what happened. And, you know, so, and we're not saying that that bias has to be for everybody, but we certainly want to encourage curiosity, encourage creativity. Some folks might want the milk spilled, you know, cleaned up a little bit faster, but we still don't have to go, oh my gosh, it's horrible that there's something here, you know, or maybe making a conscious effort rather than it being spilt milk, of it being some other kind of substance that we do intentionally to allow them to have a similar kind of an experience.
And with an older child, like getting into 3 and 4, they can learn how to clean up after and learn the coping skill. I'm not sure that's possible with a young toddler. Maybe as they're approaching 2.5 to 3, mm-hmm. they can clean it up themselves.
Yeah.
But while I'm talking about that, we'll get on further talking about a wonderful toy is something like putting in the tray part of a high chair and letting a child do finger painting, that physical manipulating is fun to do.
Yeah. And children that age are very tactile. So doing things with their hands and with it being a substance that's okay to go into their mouths because they're still very much putting things in their mouths, which I'm sure that Harriet's familiar with this, but I always tell people who may not know that when children are really young, they have sometimes even more touch receptors on their tongue than they do on their fingers. So that's part of the reason why so many things go into their mouths. So yeah, things like pudding putting it on a tray, on a high chair. So anyone who has an issue with messes, it's a win-win balanced approach there of being able to encourage the child to do that, to explore.
So then the question is, how do we keep them safe while they're investigating? And one of the first things I think you need to do is prepare the child for crawling. As far as I'm concerned, every child should learn the word hot before they crawl. And you can teach it very easily. Give in their hands something that's very warm. It's not going to burn, but it's very warm. And give them the word hot. and they will learn it. We used to think that children didn't know language until they started to speak. We know now that they learn very soon. In fact, once they know their names, they're beginning to understand language, and really shouldn't be talked about in front of them after they've gotten to that point. Mm-hmm. So anyhow, going back to keeping them safe, preparing a child for crawling, teaching them hot. You can also teach them sharp. That's not as important, but it's good to know that things can hurt. Now, you don't cut them with a knife, but you let them feel that sharp part, and you give them the word sharp. Once they start crawling, they start climbing, as I said earlier. So find some place in your house where they can crawl. Up on the couch is a wonderful one. And then when they get up on the couch, they want it to come back and have them feel, oh, there's nothing there. The couch ends. Then turn them around and have them come down feet first. So you're teaching them that a space they're on can stop. It's empty. And whenever that happens, you turn around and go foot first. My kids were crawlers, and that was so safe. Not that I didn't keep my eye open for them, but I sometimes miss. And it's better to fall on your feet than your head. And kids tend to go head first. So if you've taught them to turn around, you've given them a good safety precaution.
Yeah.
So first of all, then you prepare the children for crawling as well as the environment. And, everybody in looking at the environment has got to look at their environment and what areas parents, we adults, need, what areas can be made safe, and what areas really can't be. We did the unfortunate thing when our oldest one was first at this stage. We had to move 4 different times, and he loved it. 4 different environments to school. I don't recommend it to anybody. It drove my husband and myself nuts, but he loved it. They were interesting places, and he took off. Barring that, start looking at the areas. And one of the most fascinating areas for children is the kitchen. Now, I know that's where there are hot things, but you're not cooking all the time. And sometimes your kitchen's set up that you don't have to move hot things over walking space. So think about how you can move hot things or during cooking time to keep the children out. But when I prepare a kitchen for children, for crawling children, all of the dangerous stuff and all of the breakables go way up high. And everything else comes down. Pots and pans, wooden spoons, salad spinners, mashing, old-fashioned potato mashers, whatever that kind of equipment. They are wonderful toys that children love. And the wooden spoons, they can bang against the pots and pans. They can empty out the kitchen cabinets, and then they can crawl in and see how that's like. And they may want the door shut a little bit to see what that's like. But the kitchen is a wonderful place, and the equipment are wonderful toys. You don't have to go out to the store and buy, so use them. So think about how you can make your kitchen safe and still there for your children to explore. Once a child is standing pretty firmly, help them stand on a stool so they can see what you're doing on the counter. And they can mix. It takes a while longer, but they're learning coordination. They're learning what goes into cooking. If you can stand the mess, have them stand at this kitchen sink. Water is a wonderful toy. And pouring in all those plastic containers that we get that are little ones that salad stuff comes, dressing comes in, and then the yogurt, and wonderful things for pouring in and out. And why, if you take a big container and pour it into a little container, does it spill? Children are learning all these things and their toys that are right there.
Yeah.
Then we move into the living room and play area. We didn't have a rec room when my children were small, and many of us don't have that kind of thing. And the question is, how much can parents give up the neat and orderliness of the living room and make it into a playroom for the 2 or 3 years? I shouldn't say that. When we moved from where the kids grew up, the living room floor was really worn in the middle of the floor. And the kids went to a school that had a wonderful gym teacher that did all kinds of exercise. And the middle of our living room floor is where the kids did stood on their heads and did somersaults. And so it wasn't where you walked in the floor, it was in the middle. So I don't know when your living room, you get it back again. We have it back again now, I assure you. But my point is, look at your living space, and if you can make it over. We had a glass, loved a glass top coffee table. Well, that went into storage when the kids mm-hmm. were little. We got out a piece of driftwood and put it on bricks. And this could become a roadway. It could become something to walk across, like a, you know, when they walk on a line. So look at your living room and think about how to make it fun for children and exciting. We wanted some clean space, and my husband always had a study in the home, and that was the space that was kids didn't go to, so we did have some of that clean, orderly area for
Right. Well, and what you're talking about, too, is making it possible for some gross motor activity. I think a lot of us, when we were younger, we had what would be considered today called free-range parenting, where it would be like, go out and go play in the neighborhood and just come back at dark. And I know there are some families who do that, and I'm sure it depends a lot upon where you live, but I think generally parents are a lot more focused on safety and caution and things like that in terms of just kind of letting kids roam. But they still need that gross motor activity. So, you know, you are talking about, well, and also if you have often lived in very cold weather areas where during the winter time it might have been too cold for them to be out for any great length of time to play outside. So, you know, everybody can kind of take what you're saying in terms of their own values and location and safety and all that. But I love the creative ideas that you're coming up with. So what if they can't get outside? So what if they can't roam the way that we used to? There are ways that they can still explore and experiment and use their imagination. And some of the things we were able to do when we were roaming, we can do without roaming if parents feel like that's not safe, a safe way for them to raise kids.
And actually, with the age we're talking about, few of those children that age can roam.
Well, that's true. That's true. We are talking about the younger kids. Yeah.
The younger kids.
Yeah, you were talking about some of the things your kids did when they were older, and it got me thinking about that.
But and by the way, there is a wonderful book about free-range kids. I don't know if you've seen it yet. But in that book, she very carefully does this line between safety and free-range roaming.
That's good.
She's brought a lot of research in questioning our fears. On the other hand, that underlying theme is there of the challenge that parents are faced with of safety and exploring that we have to deal with.
Right.
Going back to preparing the environment, yes, one woman I heard about recently that had this age child had different, what we call in preschool, learning centers. And there was an area that were noisy or musical instruments, and they would change every day or so, or maybe once a week or something. Maybe it would be a bell, or maybe the next time it would be something, it would be like a drum. Then there was another that was a reading area with different books. There was a science area of she bringing things from the outside that children could explore. And another would be large activities, like you were, you know, you can sort of make a, the word skips me, but an area that kids can go through that might be a tunnel and something they have to jump over. But again, what you were bringing up, the physical activities. And parents can change these areas every now and then. Again, giving children things to explore.
So if we are talking about these younger toddlers then, and I can see some of what you're describing. I'm picturing in my mind a little bit older children. And of course, it's very possible that we've got older siblings kind of running around and doing some of those activities and also needing to keep a smaller toddler safe also. So share what's a realistic expectation or developmentally, what kinds of, because you're talking about crawling and then there would be kind of the cruising and the toddling until you get to walking. Right. So if we're kind of talking about the two-ish range, they're probably by two-ish, at least toddling and starting to walk. Some might actually be pretty good.
They're pretty good walkers by two.
Yeah, by two, they're going to be pretty good walkers.
Running, but they're definitely walking.
Yeah.
And what's the word I want when you have a course that's challenging?
Because you like a obstacle course or
what I'm looking for. And you can have a plank that goes up a little bit that kids have to walk, climb up a plank and then climb down. Or you can put up a card table and put it something over it and they have to crawl through the you can devise an obstacle course that fits the young child and the 3 and 4 year old. But it changes. And it changes according to the child, because some kids are much more adaptable, much more physical than other children. And this, again, is where the parent's role is so important, because you see what your child is age, what your child is doing, and you adapt it to where they are, and thinking about, well, what's going to challenge them a little bit more.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm not very good at saying at this age they should be doing such and such. I think parents are, I let the doctors do that. I'm much more interested in parents looking at what the kids are working on and then how can they push them a little bit.
Yeah, yeah. And for that individual child, because especially at that age, anything under age 5, it's so unique to each child where they are developmentally and what, you could have two twins and they would be at very, all the various developmental things that they're doing are very individual. So at least knowing what those ranges are and not expecting something unrealistic, you know, so you want to be familiar enough to know what's realistic, what's common, what the possibilities could be. But yeah, every child has their own individual rate and
but
style.
That individualism doesn't stop at the age 4, 5. And know that.
Yeah.
My grandchildren are now through college, and they're all so different, and the challenges are all different with every single one. We as parents are different.
Yeah, there's just fewer developmental, that 0 to 6, there's so much they're learning simultaneously, I think is what I was getting at. Once they're older, that cycle of equilibrium and disequilibrium, it kind of spreads out a little bit. There aren't quite so many packed into such a small.
Exactly.
Yeah. So one question that I have is, so as we're encouraging children to explore and to be curious, and we're doing our best to keep them safe, when there are those times where we do need to maintain those boundaries or kind of help guide them to keep them safe, since children are pre-verbal, a lot of what most of us learn or might feel comfortable with are being able to speak to children like an adult or a small child. We can kind of, you know, talk when children can converse back and forth. But during those pre-verbal years, it can be really challenging because you can't just rely on words. Yes, they might understand, but we may not be sure
if they never rely on just words. Yes.
But we can't just rely on words because they're pre-verbal. So, and to just stand there and to say something to a pre-verbal child, they could be in the danger by the time we're stepping in. So talk a little bit about some ways that when you can't speak to a when words might not be enough, or maybe they are too young to understand, offer some suggestions for what parents can do for preverbal children to help keep them safe as you're guiding.
A child running towards a car, you go grab them. A child.
And you reinforce the word dangerous. That was the one word, you know, or owie, whatever word you're, and let me just add, I tend to be rather dramatic in case you can't tell, but when I would do hot, I'd go, ooh, hot, like, or ooh, ow, and I kind of make a face so that they would really, so it isn't just words, but they would kind of get my nonverbal that this was maybe something painful.
Well, your whole body tension.
Yeah.
And the whole gestalt of scary. But when I said, when they're going towards the car, you go grab them, there are instances when you don't worry about how you're doing it. You just get them to safety.
Yeah. And safety is one of those. Yeah. And safety is like, safety trumps all. Yeah.
Safety trumps all. Other situations, I try and structure it so it stays safe. But like talking with children, even though they're pre-verbal, this is what we always do in a parking lot. We hold hands. Or with actually this age child, I would tend to carry them if I could in a parking lot or where they aren't going to be, can't be seen. Mm-hmm. And it's too easy for them to run. I'd rather keep them close.
Yeah. And I think it never hurts to, even if you think your child doesn't understand what you're saying, I always tell parents, still practice all the skills that you're learning, you know, like from us in our classes, still practice all of that because we need the practice so we get good at being able to think quickly and speak effectively so that when they do understand, then we've gotten through our learning curve.
They're understanding more than we most likely think they are. I'll never forget my youngest child. She was still crawling, and it was one of those days we were rushing to get out of the house, and I couldn't find her other shoe. She had one shoe on, and I was, I was muttering, where could we put that shoe and you're looking for it? And she came to me with the shoe in her mouth.
Oh, wow.
What I was looking for. I mean, she knew she only had one. She knew where it was, and she brought it to me. So that's why I made that comment. We shouldn't talk about our children. Yeah. This one's shy. This one's this one's this. This one's that. We're setting expectations for them, and they're taking it in. They may think, this is the way I'm supposed to be.
But Or maybe that there's something wrong with it, depending upon the words that we use. If it's like, you know... And you know, if we remember that nonverbal communication is over 90% of our communication, it's not just what we say, just thinking it, just perceiving our child as somehow their temperament makes them less than whole or that it's somehow judged to be a negative, it comes across in things like tone of voice or body language, which kids are very intuitive. They very much pick up on that nonverbal because they aren't yet verbal. So that's everything to them. They can pick up on that disapproval or frustration. And because of that age and because they're more egocentric in that their world tends to revolve around them, they will often internalize that in it being that, oh, you don't like me, which is not anything that anybody has ever said, maybe even thought. But you start combining these different things. You know, there's the nonverbal, and then there's the developmental age that they're at and their perspective of the world. And it kind of comes together that kids, this is why kids sometimes will misinterpret a situation differently than what we intended. Or, you know, you could ask an adult, and they might say, well, when I was a child, my mother said such and such. Well, she might not have ever said that, but somehow they got that message. So yeah, there's a lot that's happening nonverbally with preverbal children, both directions, both to and from in our communication with them.
Yeah, I do want to say something about the temperament, though. I've always felt sorry that the chess work on temperament wasn't better known, because she really devised 9, and now there are 10 temperament patterns that I find parents can quite easily identify with. And we know that there are biological basis for these patterns and that kids tend to have them. And some of them get in their way and some of them don't. I think the parent, for me, the parent role is how to help the child live with the temperament pattern that they are given. Mm-hmm. Trying not to give that bias that you're talking mm-hmm. about, but this is the way you are, and these are the advantages, and these are the disadvantages. And one I have to always bring up is one of them is being persevere with the task. And when you're teaching preschool and it's time to move to sack time and this child's got to finish that building, perseverance is a pain, or when it's supper time and the child won't come. But if you want to finish your doctoral dissertation, you need that perseverance. So, okay. You know, how do we work with the temperament patterns our kids come with?
Yes. And teaching them skills, because there are some that don't mesh real well with maybe a traditional school setting or a traditional work setting. And so it may be a disadvantage when in that setting, and you may not always be able to avoid it. So also it's teaching life skills to kids. So, you know, for things like transitions, you know, making transition from one activity to another, we can help them with that so that when they're maybe in junior high and they're having to go to a different class every 40 minutes, and they're on their own and we're not there to help them anymore, that they have some of those skills to be able to take their normal temperament and be able to adapt in those kinds of situations.
The tasks are for the child who sticks with something to be able to leave it and move on.
Yeah.
One I think we run into so much is the shy child, the child that tends to withdraw. And first of all, try not to talk about he's shy, but help him figure out how he can go to the birthday party and have a good time. Some of these children work better if they get there before everybody else and get involved. Some if they go with another child. Some if you help them move in and get involved. But learning how to help the child go into a situation and be able to enjoy it.
Mm-hmm. Allow them time to observe before they interact. Yeah, for some
however
kids, they're watchers first.
In, however they can move in, mm-hmm. and different kids do different ways. And with, at different developmental stages, they do it differently. So.
Yeah, again, we've got these different layers. Yeah.
Exactly.
So, and I'm glad that you brought up temperaments. And for those who are listening, in the Parents Tool Shop book, if you have it, it's chapter 11 has a summary of developmental stages, of temperaments. So if you need a little quick refresher on that, that chapter is probably on my website somewhere. So maybe I'll look that up and point people to that if you want to learn more about temperaments. And if you want to, in the chat, type the researcher that you thought was had particularly good temperament research. I took mine from the book Mary Sheedy Kirchinka, Raising Your Spirited Child, and it was about temperaments, but I have to be honest that I'm not quite remembering what research she based it on. So did you mention a particular researcher that you thought was good?
Yes, there's one I use in all of my books.
Okay, tell me, and maybe I'll type it into the chat.
It's Stella Chess, C-H-E-S. Actually, it's in my book, Using Your Values, Raising a Child You Admire as an Adult.
Okay, give me the name of your book again. I'll type it into the chat, too.
Raising Your Child. It's Using Your Values to Raise a Child You Admire as an Adult. I like long titles, obviously.
And I know I have it on here in one of your... Okay, Using Your Values to Raise Your Child. Did I say that right?
To be an adult you admire.
To raise your child into an adult.
To be. Raise your child to be.
To be an adult you admire. There we go. Okay. So Stella Chess and the title of your book are now in the chat.
Very good.
So awesome.
Going back to the environment, We've talked about the indoor environment. Kids also need opportunities, and we've talked a little bit about the outdoor environment. Our children are being held inside so much. And I was just recently working with a woman who wasn't taking her kids out, and it made such a difference when they get out, and it does. And she's been very creative. There's a community college nearby with a lovely campus, and they go explore there. So, you know, I encourage parents to look for some place in your environment where you can go and let kids roam. And these exploring children, especially once they start walking, but even when they're crawling, excuse me, if you can let them go and you just sort of follow them and let them just wander, what do they look at? And you can talk about what you look at. Mm-hmm. If you get itchy doing it, I used to take my knitting along so that my hands were busy while I was following them. My daughter has sewed pieces together, made beautiful quilts. So do something to keep yourself busy and take care of yourself while you're following this wandering child and what they're looking at and doing an honoring with them as they go along. So I did just want to say that about
you. Yeah, and for me, that's my favorite age, because when I was a child, I had to grow up very quickly. I have a trauma history, so I had to grow up very quickly. I was very grown up, had to take care of myself and raise myself, and I don't think I really learned how to play. I got to play mommy, and I played teacher and secretary and all those grown-up things, but I really loved the fact I love about being a parent and now as a grandparent is that age where they are exploring and they're playing, and I just mimic them. It's like they're teaching me how to play, how to be a child, and it's given me an opportunity to experience the childhood of childhood that maybe I didn't get an opportunity to have when I was a child.
Yeah, that's great. I'm going to move us on because I realize time's going and there's one part of the environment we really haven't touched
about. Okay. And I put a message out to anyone who's on. If you all want to interact with Harriet, just type into the chat and we'll let you know, and you can unmute yourself and take yourself onto the video so you can talk to Harriet before we're done.
Great. And that's the people in the environment. We've sort of been talking about the toys.
Yeah.
One toy we've not mentioned are boxes. If I was going to raise children this age again, I would go to the nearest liquor store. And they put out boxes for moving. And they are strong boxes. And I would bring a lot home because you could do all kinds of building and they cost you absolutely nothing. You know, they have bottles in them, so they're very strong when they're empty.
And let me just add, not to interrupt, but appliance stores and grocery stores are actually really good. I did I was the coach of a kids thing where the kids needed to find their own supplies. And I found that appliance, because you can get really big boxes to like make houses out of and things at the appliance store. Yeah.
And they're wonderful. Yeah. Anyhow, boxes of all shapes and sizes are to be cherished and used. But I want to talk about the people in the environment. We've talked about the role of the parents, and parents know their children and how they're guiding this whole process to provide this environment that's interesting, as well as keeping them safe. But there are also sibs in the environment. There may be older siblings, and you know, we've talked so much about sibling rivalry. We don't talk about helping sibs be friends. I was in a program where we were talking about, in the elementary schools, what goes on in parenting and how parents relate to children. And we found the parents started telling us that their fifth and sixth graders were coming home and playing with the toddlers because they'd learned how. This is how you roll a ball to a toddler. This is how you show a car to a baby. This is how you set up a game so you can play together. So the older siblings need to learn how to relate to that younger one, including the two and a half year old where a new siblings come. And they'll say something like, I'm going to play baseball with my new brother when he comes. Well, he's telling you he doesn't know anything about a new baby. Take him to see what the new baby is. Talk to him about what he can do with that new baby. Help them become, develop to be friends.
Mm-hmm. And let me just add, and how to handle conflict, or when the baby is, the toddler's acting like a toddler and they're frustrated that they're getting into their space or they're grabbing their toys, or of teaching them helpful ways of responding besides just grabbing back and fighting and all that.
That's the perfect place for a playpen. The older child gets in the playpen and does the building. The older child can look, but not boy.
That's what I did, because I don't believe in playpens. And somebody gave us a hand-me-down, and my son said, oh, I want to get in there. So my son, my older, would get in, and he would be the one in the playpen, and then that way my little one could wander and be free.
Exactly. Yeah. Because your older ones, things do need to be protected.
Mm-hmm.
And all that needs to go on too. I feel we're skipping over the surface of many, many issues here.
Well, yeah, and especially touching on siblings. That is my trauma history, is with my sibling. Mm-hmm. So yeah, so I'm very, very much about, I love teaching them how to interact in appropriate ways. And then also you got to teach them how to work things out, not just say, go work things out. So.
And that starts very, very early. I have my two girls who have children happened to have kids very close in age. And so it was a real treat when they got together. And when Lennon and Ben were just toddlers, we heard them scream and we went out to see what was going on. And they had a dump truck, a toy dump truck. And each child had one end of it pulling on it, saying the other one wouldn't share.
Oh, no.
Now, what does sharing mean to a 14-year-old? Yeah. Absolutely nothing.
Yeah.
You're right. That's when we needed to intervene. We asked the boys, well, first of all, we gave them a snack, maybe read a story so that they were. Then we asked them, what did you want to do? Well, they wanted to, they were moving a sand around. Well, one child could drive the truck to the sand pile. You have to teach them how to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Or mm-hmm. you set the timer.
Yeah, because they may not understand sharing and ownership, but they can learn how to take turns.
And ownership is an abstract term.
Yes, for a two-year-old it is. Yeah, you have to understand mind before you can understand share, and that comes a little bit later.
And this is an important part of the parent role, not only keeping them safe, but helping them learn new next steps. Because what you're describing in helping them problem solve and conflict resolution, which they really can't do until they're 3, 4, 5, 7, 8, 9, 10, and so on. But those are skills that have to be taught.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. As soon as children are old enough to have an opinion and voice an opinion, then they're old enough that you can start involving them in problem solving. So.
Well, I hadn't thought about it that way, but as long as they can brainstorm, they can start.
Yes, yes, and that's having an opinion or ideas. Yeah.
You know, this brings on one of my real biases in the whole sibling, and I have several of them which are coming out. But so often there's a whole line of thinking, parents, stay out of it. Kids are only fighting to get attention. They may, but too often they don't know how to resolve the conflict.
Yeah.
I know when my grandsons got to 7, 8, or 9, the mom would listen to see if they were applying their skills or if they needed help. And so often we give parents advice, do or don't do, instead of saying, listen, figure out what's going on and decide if you need to intervene.
Mm-hmm.
You know, parenting is balancing in so many ways, don't you think?
Absolutely. I often say, I don't tell parents what to think. I just help them learn how to think so that when they're in that situation, it's not, oh, cookie cutter, you know, it's that they have the information to process what's happening in that situation and identify what kind of problem is it and do they need to get involved. And I have 7 issues that are parent issues that they need to step in if that's it. And one of the very first one is safety. So it is critical thinking as parents. Yeah.
And isn't it funny that so many people think that parenting is instinctive? and you just know how to do it. The truth.
Most of it is learned skills. And if you don't learn them somewhere, it can be, not that you won't do it well. I think that some people maybe do have some instincts and intuition that guides them pretty well. But for a lot of us, there's a lot of counterintuitive things about parenting that you would think it'd be this way, but actually research shows it's this way. It's like, oh, well, that's a whole other.
See, I think Freud gave us the idea it was instinctive.
Oh, well, there you go. We've learned a lot of what he said.
Yeah, the research is showing that basically as infants, and you may have missed this in your background, I don't know you that well, but how we are raised is how we learn to parent.
Oh, absolutely.
But we're not stuck with that. Mm-hmm. You know, people look around and they think, well, I like how my parents did this, but I sure didn't like that. So then we change it. And we're learning, well, but it's not starting with an instinct. Mm-hmm. In fact, the zoo people tell me with monkeys, if a monkey has been raised in isolation, it won't know to put the baby to breast. They have to go to it. So that's my bias on instinct. Well, there's research.
Yeah.
Actually, I did my doctoral dissertation on that, but we'll move on. Because
So let me just give the opportunity, if anyone wants to come off of mute or to turn on your camera, you're welcome to do that and interact with Harriet. We have almost 10 minutes left. You should be able to unmute yourselves. If you are not able to unmute yourself, text me in the chat because I think you are able to. So let us know. Is there anything in particular that maybe Harriet hasn't touched on that you maybe came hoping to get today? Those of you who are listening. Sometimes folks just come just appreciating being fed. We are over the lunch break here in Ohio, so they may be on their lunch break too, literally feeding themselves as well as listening too. So just let me know in the chat if you'd like to talk to Harriet. So were there any maybe kind of some final pointers that you want to make sure that you cover while we're together about these young two-year-olds?
I want to go back to what they're learning, because it's so easy to miss. And some of the research is so funny. One of the things, the researchers must have had fun with this, but one they did, they electrified the chairs in a daycare with toddlers. So the chairs—
Electrified?
Well, they motorized.
Oh, okay. I'm picturing electric chair.
So they could move the chairs around.
Okay.
And at a certain age, and I tried to look up the age, but it was in this stage, the kids would just move around with the chairs and it was all fine. And so the chairs were moving, the children were moving, and all was well. 3 or 4 months later, the same thing happened and the children stopped and looked. What had happened there is that the children had come to understand chairs don't move by themselves.
Oh. So
that kind of subtle learning that's going on as our kids move into the environment. And if you stand back, you can sometimes watch it. I remember watching a child, they just picked some rhubarb. It was in the spring, and they just picked some rhubarb. And he picked up a piece and bit into it. You know, it's just—
Oh, bitter.
Then he made this awful face. Then he picked up another piece and bit into it and made another awful face. There were about 6 there, and he did all 6. And his mom said, well, isn't he crazy? You know, didn't he know? Children don't know that because it looks alike, it tastes alike. They have to test it out.
Well, I love the fact that he tried it more than once. I have a son who is one strike, you're out. Like, he would have tasted it once and he would have never touched anything that even looked or smelled like it again. And I think that you can't always judge after the first try.
But
I admire that.
My hunch is he was older. This child was in the toddler stage, because that toddler didn't recognize that they were all the same. Mm-hmm. Now, what you're saying is he tasted it once. He knew they were all the same, and he didn't like it, and he wouldn't do the next step. The child I was describing didn't know that they were all the same. There's a program up here. It's a beautiful music camp, and they have an orchestra, and they have a museum, a touch day with the instruments. And I watched a little guy go to the big bass files and strum the strings. Then he went to the next one and did the same thing. He was testing the same. Did they all sound alike?
Mm-hmm.
And children have to learn the assumption that when one thing looks like this, it's going to taste the same.
Yeah.
If we pick up an orange and it tastes like an apple, we're surprised because we've learned to anticipate.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I really appreciate all the ideas that you're giving us for things that we can do with young children besides putting them in front of a screen. And I don't mean to open up a whole other can of worms 3 minutes before we have to close, because I know that's like a whole other thing. And I think anyone who's watching and listening to this knows that the research is showing that it's not good for kids' brains. But I think often it's such an easy fallback.
You know that the American Association of Pediatricians have changed their position on screen time.
What are they saying?
Because they found screen time was very important with grandparents far away. And so they're now saying if it's a chat time.
Yeah, certain. Oh, absolutely.
We need to look at the child, the context, and what they're watching.
Sure.
And no screen time. I have to bring that in because I'm a grandparent with grandchildren far away.
Yeah. I'm talking about the kind where I'm going to just sit my child in front of a screen because I don't know what to do with them, or I don't either have the time, the knowledge, or, you know, what you're suggesting, to be honest, takes work, and it takes creativity, and it takes some planning. And well, you know, if you're going to really achieve, you know, to be an effective parent and help children achieve their developmental goals, and if you think about what your ultimate goals are as a parent to help your child develop all these skills and qualities, that's what it takes. Like, and it's at those young ages that we make that investment, that it really does pay off later. So I appreciate the specific examples you've given for things that parents can do with young ones.
We are developing this internal representation. And as you say, if it's a flat representation, mm-hmm. they're just catching their attention.
Mm-hmm.
They're not touching, they're not tasting, they're not manipulating. They're not building that internal representation on which they will build their reading in the future. And
yeah.
That is so true. So parents can ask themselves, and you're right, it takes thought and it takes energy, but it gets away from the no to working with that curiosity of the child.
Yeah.
And you can ask, is the child safe? Is it interesting? And how can I support it?
Yes, and it's also promoting brain development instead of being in a passive mode of just looking at something. It's building their, and all those wonderful connections, their senses and gross motor, fine motor, all those various things, because you shared a really wonderful variety of activities.
And that I can do.
Yeah.
I can walk around. I can experiment. I can.
Yes, yes. So in our final minute, I'm just going to take everybody off mute. And let everybody say thank you to you. Let's see, I'm going to unmute and unmute. And so unmute, there we go. Oh, no, it's not letting me unmute. So maybe that person is choosing to stay muted. So anyone who would like to say thank you to Harriet, you can join me right now in saying thank you.
Oh, my pleasure. And enjoy those curious kids. They are such fun.
They are. So thank you, everybody, for coming. Harriet, thank you again. It was wonderful to see you again. I'm so grateful to have webinars to connect with my colleagues around the world. So thank you again, Harriet, for joining us today.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Yes, thank you. And thank you everyone for coming and supporting Harriet and participating in the chat and asking questions. And we hope to see you here again next month. If you aren't yet become a part of the Parents Tool Shop, either the Facebook group, Parents Tool Shop Consulting, our page, or parentstoolshop.com, go to contact us and get on our mailing list. And that way I can let you know what's going to be coming up in future months. Next month we have scheduled actually to discuss internet. And so that won't be with toddlers, that'll be with older kids, but we are going to be talking about internet. So we're going to be talking more about screens next month. So if you're interested in that, you can come back then. So, all right. Take care, everybody.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Thank you. Thanks, Deborah.